Chapter 29, Community Beginnings. I had to get a permit from the building department before beginning construction at the meditation retreat. At the building department, I learned that I also needed a permit from the county health department. Hal Cox, the superintendent there, placed us in the category church camp. Had we been listed otherwise, we'd have needed a further permit, something I didn't know at the time, from the planning department. Being a church camp spared us more bureaucratic red tape and probably the need to spend more money for the project than I even had. I'm sure many people have lamented the regulations that force them to spend considerable amounts of money simply to be able to begin earning money, or, as in my case, to be of service to others. If only there were a way for people, young people especially, starting out in life, with little capital but with lots of energy, ideas, and enthusiasm, to launch a project without the burden of bureaucratic restrictions. I wonder if this isn't one reason some people, anxious to serve God, have gone off as missionaries to far-off places like Africa. In less developed countries, these restrictions are at least few or non-existent. People can devote their energies in more worthwhile directions. Spring of 1969 arrived, and people began arriving at Ananda in slowly increasing numbers. A few came as families. I intended to build a community eventually far from the retreat. God encouraged me in this intention by sending us a few particularly noisy children at the outset. Meditations in the temple became a brow-furrowing background to gleeful shouts, angry accusations, and bitter tears over which no one had the slightest control. One couple, Ray and Burma Harilla, arrived with their small daughter, Cece. They were a sweet and unassuming couple, but Cece definitely was a presence. I remember Jyotish telling me, I was sitting on my deck one morning when Cece approached it from the side. The top of her head barely reached the level of the deck. Disdaining the obvious solution of climbing the steps, she studied the problem a moment, then said, looks tough. I guess I'll have to give it my full blast. Everything Cece did was full blast. Children's restless energy at a meditation retreat is a dubious blessing, and Cece had 10 times as much energy as the average child. That we needed other land, and soon, was becoming more obvious every day. At that time, and for many months to come, I continued teaching in the cities. I was therefore able to come to Ananda only on weekends. A friend of mine in Sacramento, Dr. Gordon Runnels, learning that we needed more land, mentioned a property he'd heard about from a real estate agent friend of his. "It's in your general area, I think," he said. Our general area, however, included places as far away as Auburn, 50 miles to the south. I shelved his news mentally, thinking it wasn't time yet in any case to take on another venture. The first week of June, however, I received a letter from Dick Baker, who was in Japan. He had heard of an influx of people at Ananda and somehow got the impression that I was building a town. Distressed, naturally, he reminded me that the property we'd bought together was intended for seclusion. "Please," he wrote desperately, "do no more construction until I return from Japan in the fall. We can then meet and discuss these things." Not many people had come yet, but, in fact, if a community was to begin at all, spring, not autumn, was the time to do it. The delay Dick wanted couldn't have come at a worse time for us. God's ways of forcing us to move forward, however, are not always those we ourselves would choose. Dick's letter arrived on a Friday morning. "Divine Mother," I prayed, "help me to find a solution. I don't want Dick to regret having included me in his venture, On the other hand, I can't control who comes to Ananda. What am I to do? I was about to leave San Francisco for another weekend at Ananda. Accompanying me was Sandy Miller, a student and friend who had expressed interest in the project. Married since then, her name became Sandy Ross. My father and her husband, Ed, became friends. On our way to Ananda, we stopped at Gordon Runnels' office in Sacramento. Another friend of Dr. Runnels stopped by. As we waited for Gordon, this man told me that he was a real estate agent and took the opportunity to speak about what he called, quote, the hottest real estate buy I've ever seen. I began to realize that this was probably the man Gordon had spoken of. From Gordon's description, I'd surmised that the property was unlikely to be very near Ananda. My doubts increased when this man said it was, quote, somewhere north of Auburn, which made it seem almost a suburb of that town. Out of politeness only, therefore, I asked if he had a map he could show me. He pulled one out of a pocket and spread it on a table. The map was of Ananda's exact area. Things all at once looked promising. The property he pointed to was only 6 miles from Ananda Retreat. With Dick Baker's letter lying heavy in my pocket, I asked, "Would you care to show it to me?" "When would you like to go?" "Would this afternoon suit you?" "I'm free," he said. "We could leave now." The three of us drove up that afternoon. Gordon, unfortunately, had appointments and couldn't join us. "The owner of this land," said the agent, "is a Mr. Sylvester. He has terminal cancer and is anxious to settle his affairs as soon as possible. He's had most of the property subdivided into 40-acre parcels. It isn't even on the market yet, but already the guys in the office are fixing to place options on some of the parcels for themselves and are getting their friends interested." In the fading daylight, we walked over some of the most beautiful countryside I have ever seen. I asked him, "Could you hold a few of these parcels for me over the weekend?" I told him which ones I wanted. They amounted to most of the property. "I can certainly give it a try," he replied. The down payment for those pieces came to $13,500. An unthinkably high sum, especially considering that I'd have to raise promises of loans or donations over that weekend. If God wants us to have it, I reasoned, He'll work everything out. I'd never been one to attract wealthy donors, perhaps because of a deep-seated aversion to letting anyone think he owns me. I knew many people, however, and a number of them had at least a certain amount of money. I sat down and made telephone calls. By Saturday morning, less than 24 hours after getting Dick Baker's letter, I'd received promises totaling $13,500. I phoned the agent. "To play it safe," he said, "I went into the office at 2 o'clock this morning and took the listings you wanted off the board. It's lucky I did. When the office opened today, 5 or 6 of the fellows came and pleaded with me to free up at least one of the parcels. By getting those promises of help so quickly, you've snatched the land right out from under their noses." Thus we obtained Ananda Farm, and not so far away from the meditation retreat, that both couldn't have the same identity. Interestingly, most of the original promises of assistance fell through. God had other ways of raising the money when the down payment actually came due. For the time being, however, those first promises gave us the confidence we needed to proceed. The farm purchase had a particularly touching sequel. I had been sorry that this good fortune should have been ours as a result of someone else's misfortune. Later, I happened to meet the former owner's doctor, Robert Hume. Dr. Hume, speaking of Mr. Sylvester's cancer, which he said had indeed been terminal, told me it had vanished quite marvelously after we acquired the land. By an interesting coincidence, Dr. Hume's wife was the daughter of family friends of mine in Scarsdale, New York. Their residence had been on the same road as ours, Claremont Road. We'd lived at 13 Claremont before moving to Bright Avenue, 90 Bright Avenue, in the same town. How many threads weave themselves into the tapestry of a person's life? I'd again met her father, Harry Gibbon, in Patna, India, at the airport. I was seated at a table, chatting with friends, wearing the orange robe of a swami. I had let my hair grow long and had a beard. Thus I was, or so one would have thought, quite unrecognizable to someone who hadn't seen me since I was a teenager. This man came over and said, "Say, from your voice you sound like one of the Walters." Mr. Gibbon was retired and was acting as a consultant for some firm in Bombay. Harriet, their daughter, another thread, had a crush on my brother Bob when she was 7 years old and he 18.
"When I grow up," she asked him, "will you marry me?"
He took her childish proposal lightly, of course. "Sure," he said, smiling offhandedly. A few years later, however, when he married someone else, she took it very hard. "You promised," she wailed bitterly. Harriet must have been 11 at that time. Dr. Hume became my doctor for a time, until he and Harriet moved away. After that, we gradually lost contact with each other. Ananda began in truth as a community with the purchase of Ananda Farm. On July 4, 1969, we signed the papers that committed us to buying it. Now began a population explosion that we nearly didn't survive. The news spread by an amazingly efficient grapevine that a new, quote, commune was starting up and wanted members. People began arriving from points north, south, east, and west. One afternoon alone, there were 7 cars parked in our driveway, full of people eager to join. We did manage gradually to sift through this landslide of humanity and select from it a fair number of viable candidates. It was a slow process. Strange as it may seem, comparatively few of my hundreds of yoga students ever became residents of Ananda. Most of those who came now had never studied with me, knew little or nothing about me, very little, if anything, about Paramhansa Yogananda or his teachings, and were in no way interested in fulfilling Yogananda's or my communitarian dreams. They came because communes were the vogue, and it seemed to them an easy and comfortable way of avoiding worldly responsibility. This mass migration raised several important questions. We did indeed need numbers, for without them it wouldn't be possible to develop anything on our several hundred acres of land. We also needed help with the mortgage, which amounted to $1,750 a month, a large sum in those days. I had no intention of compromising my ideals, however, and therefore had to establish a few guidelines. Though I wanted as few rules as possible, I'd already decided on 2 as essential: no drugs and no alcohol. The anti-drug rule concerned hallucinogenic drugs, of course, not medications. Most of those coming were of the hippie, hallucinogenic drug culture. They couldn't even understand why I would want such a rule. Many of them assumed I meant only no drugs on Ananda's land, perhaps as a legal protection. But wasn't what they did off the property their own business? It took some time to persuade them that joining Ananda meant a personal commitment, not a casual excuse. I'd seen at Mount Washington how a surfeit of rules can destroy the spirit, as Master had warned me when I organized the monks there. For a time, notices used to be posted almost weekly on our bulletin board from the main office, informing us of a stream of new rules, regulations, and procedures. When I organized the main office after Master's passing, it was to streamline and simplify matters, not to impose rigid controls. Other people, however, had welcomed my reorganization with the glad cry, "Finally, we're getting organized." Happily, they added to the momentum, going from simplicity to ever-increasing complexity, imagining they'd found in the organizing process itself the key to efficiency. I myself felt that all they were producing was an ideational labyrinth. Atananda, faced again with the need for bringing order out of chaos, I determined to depend not on rules, but on the creative exercise of common sense. For I wanted everyone to have the freedom to grow in personal understanding and ability, and not to have decisions imposed on him or her from above. Only thus, I felt, could Ananda grow vigorously instead of slowly losing its first momentum. From the beginning, the decision-making process was kept as close to the grassroots level as possible. People who were involved in a project were given an active say in whatever concerned them. We also permitted people to introduce a personal style into their activities, rather than force them all into the same mold. I determined on certain guidelines also for myself. Never coerce. Never pull rank on anyone. Win others to a view by letting them convince themselves, rather than by overwhelming them with reasons or with my own conviction. Naturally, my enthusiasm did count for something. Without the yeast of strong leadership, Ananda would have come out a flat pancake. Strong leadership, however, means leading, not driving. It means having the inner strength to be patient with others, to absorb the blows of opposition, to be completely fair to everyone, and never to play favorites. What I tried to do was inspire a kindred enthusiasm in others rather than impose on anyone my own enthusiasm. I let others think things through for themselves without pressure from me. If I saw that someone was agreeing to a proposal only to go along with me, I let the matter rest until I saw that he or she really did agree. Tepid support, I've always felt, is almost worse than no support at all, for when it is put to the test, it often fizzles out, and generally when you most need it. If I called a group meeting, I tried to give people on all sides of an issue a fair hearing. However, I kept the reins of such meetings in my own hands, never allowing discussion to descend to a verbal free-for-all. I did my best to get people not to think in terms of what they themselves wanted, but rather to ask what is right, what will benefit everybody. Inwardly, I always prayed for my guru's guidance, that his will be my own point of departure, rather than any consideration of personal feelings or biases. What I hoped to establish was a dharmocracy, not a democracy. Dharmocracy, a rule by what is spiritually right, I defined as a community dedicated to actions leading to soul freedom rather than to further ego involvement. Ego-centeredness is the root cause of spiritual ignorance, but dedication to doing God's will leads to wisdom. Ego-motivated desires are self-imprisoning, whereas desirelessness is the way to perfect freedom. Ego-attachment is bondage, whereas non-attachment is essential for those who seek true soul fulfillment. Ananda itself, I insisted, is merely a thing. Don't be attached to it. Don't imagine that we'll ever create another Garden of Eden here. Ananda can never achieve perfection, for outer perfection is a delusion, forever unattainable. Be attached only to doing God's will.